Sunset Lake CBD is a majority employee-owned hemp farm located right outside of Burlington, Vermont. Before they started growing hemp, Sunset Lake Farms produced cream for Ben & Jerry's. Sunset Lake CBD doesn't use any pesticides or herbicides to grow any of its hemp plants, and they use organic fertilizer and other sustainable farming techniques to ensure the long-term health of the soil and to minimize their carbon footprint. So like all of us, my days are really stressful. By the end of the night, my kids are in bed, I'm taking a minute to chill, but I'm still unwinding. I recently started using the Relax Gummies infused with CBD isolate, reishi mushroom extract, and ashwagandha root extract. I'm really glad I tried these because they really helped me get ready for a good night of sleep, and I really think I sleep better, so I'd highly recommend it. Check out Sunset Lake CBD today at sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code UNDERMINE for 20% off your order. That's sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code UNDERMINE for 20% off your order. Farmer-owned, Vermont-grown, Sunset Lake CBD. Hey listeners, I want to tell you about Music Masters Collective, a nonprofit organization that produces unique music events, providing opportunities for fans and artists to meet and collaborate in an inspired and creative atmosphere. These events give you the opportunity to learn from world-class musicians like the Fab Four, Steve Earle, Richard Thompson, John Scofield, Nels Klein, the Milk Carton Kids, and many more. This June, join the Wait Band, featuring members of the band and the Levon Helm Band with special guests, including Jimmy Vivino, Bob Margolin, Lost Leaders, Chris O'Leary, Cindy Cashdollar, Stony Creek Band, Rob Fraboni, Larry Packer, and so many more at Camp Cripple Creek. This all-inclusive music vacation in the Catskill Mountains of upstate New York promises to be a once-in-a-lifetime experience featuring performances, workshops, jams, comfortable lodging, and superb dining. Visit campcripplecreek.com/undermine to register today. That's campcripplecreek.com/undermine.
Osiris.
Hey, everybody, we're back. Welcome to season 4 of the Undermine podcast by Osiris Media. And I am Tom Marshall, your host of these proceedings. And here we are at episode 30, a few shows into the wonderful fall 97 tour where Phish destroyed America. In fact, November 1997 at the University of Illinois is the fifth show of the tour. They'd played two shows in Colorado just prior to this. And RJ and I were thrilled and delighted to talk on the last episode about one of those shows with the man from Phish himself, Trey Anastasio. And I'm very pleased to say that again, I'm here with the placid but deadly chief executive of Osiris, my co-host, RJB.
Wow. That was just too much. That was too much. Thank you, Tom. Well, as you well know, or if you don't know, you will know now, this was my first Fall 97 show, this show in Champaign on 11/19/97. We have a good guest here to discuss the show. It was a real barn burner inside of an actual spaceship, so we'll have to get into that. But first, if you're enjoying what we're doing, please consider supporting our new Osiris Premium offering. We have a lot of stuff for you. You've heard us talk about it before. OsirisPod.com/premium. And you can support what we're doing here at Osiris. And we are all booked with all of our guests for all of these Fall 97 shows, but we want to hear your memories too. So send us a video clip of you talking about the show of your choice and make it 60 seconds max. Post it on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, tag Osiris Pod, and you could win a wonderful prize, which is handwritten lyrics of the song Ghost from Tom Marshall. Thomas, who do we have on the show today?
Sorry, you threw me because I was just trying to remember what the lyrics for Ghost were. put on the spot. I'll have them right by the time I write it down, I hope. Today, we are very, very pleased to have as our guest, Andy Kahn. Andy is the editorial director of Jambase, and I'm going to bring him in from the waiting room right now so he can talk to us. Andy, hello.
Hello.
All right, hi, you
guys.
Made it. Welcome,
here, yes.
Welcome to Undermine, Andy. I have a quick curveball question right out of the gate for the editorial director at Jambase. What's the most exciting thing happening musically in the world right now or recently, you know, the current big topic around the Jambase water cooler?
I'll tell you, it's King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard. They are on the tips of everybody's tongues. They're on everybody's headphones. I think half of Jambase is going to see them tonight at Red Rocks. They just really seem to have caught fire. It only took them 25 albums or whatever to catch on. But
in 3 years.
yeah. But they are definitely the talk of Jambase these days, for sure.
Cool.
And rightly so.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, I'm always late to the party, and I have yet to really jump in. RJ kindly has sent me a few cool things to listen to, and Trey too. And
Yeah,
all sounds excellent. Yeah. Trey loves them. And he says he's jealous of them in a way. Just because
I think you writing just saw him out in New York. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, Andy, there's a rumor that you were at this show in November 1997. Could you quickly bring us up to speed on your fish journey up to this point?
Yeah, so I was there. I was 17 years old. I was freshly 17 years old, a junior in high school. It was probably around my eighth or ninth time seeing them at that point. I saw my first show, actually, in Champaign at Assembly Hall in the fall of 95. I was 14 years old at the time. I managed to, as I got a little bit older, got my driver's license and whatnot, was able to catch him whenever I could around the Midwest. And I saw Alpine and Deer Creek in 97, and then did the Champaign show. And then I actually then went and saw them in Detroit on the fall tour as well.
When you were 14, did you have a cool like older brother or older friends or something?
I was going to ask the same thing.
Yeah.
I had my older cousin Stacy. She actually took me to see the Grateful Dead when I was 13.
Shout out to Stacy.
Yeah, and her and her boyfriend Kevin took me to see the Dead when I was 13, and then the next year I went back to see the Dead with my mom. So she's definitely a cool influence, and then a few months later I saw Fish for the first time. So my 14 was a pretty formative year for me.
Awesome,
that is great, Andy. And this was the first show for me of the fall tour. I was in college at Ohio State, and we drove to Champaign, and first of all, the crowd was just raucous from the start, and it comes through on the tapes pretty heavily. Mm-hmm. But also I mentioned earlier, like Assembly Hall really does look like a spaceship, like not in the same way that Hampton does, but when I remember walking up there and being like, what the hell is this place? And then going in, and we were like the first row off the floor, and it just, in my memory, it was just a total party from the very moment the lights went out. What's your memory of kind of, going in and also just like the start of that show?
I remember being very, very excited to be back in Champaign. Like, it was where I had seen my first show. So I was having lots of flashbacks and memories to that. And I also do definitely remember there just being a heightened sense of excitement. I think it was their first time back in the Midwest in a while. We had been hearing things, obviously the internet wasn't quite what it was back then, but we still had Andy Gadiel's Fish page and stuff. And so it was like, we knew there were some cool things happening. They had just played Farmhouse on Conan. So it was like, we were ready for something big, and it definitely seemed like they were too.
Yeah, that's a great there was something about that, the era. I mean, it just felt like there was there's something in the air, and fall shows are so great, and fall shows indoor in the Midwest are, in my mind anyway, so some of the best. It's interesting because in the Fish book, Trey is quoted as saying that he didn't like one of the sets from this show, which when I was listening back to it this time, I was thinking like, First of all, which set was it? And and also, I disagree, no matter what, because I think the whole show is pretty great. But we should get into that, because I'm curious if you have any theories about that. But because the show really starts off, I mean, the Julius and the bathtub gin into llama with this just like amazing transition between bathtub gin and llama. It's just all this stuff is kind of burned into my memory. But well, tell us, what are some of your highlights from the first set? And which set do you think Trey was talking about?
I really hope it's the first set. I mean,
right, right. I mean it's the only one that it logically kind of makes sense. I didn't know that until we started talking about this show specifically. And going back and listening to it, I kind of did get the sense, and also just the large number of songs in the first set compared to the second anyway. I was thinking like maybe Trey, you know, keeps trying to find the one that's satisfying him for some reason, not realizing that every single one is satisfying us.
Yeah. Yeah. Obviously the bathtub gin stands out to me. It's really, I love early first set jams. You know, I like when they bring the improvisation early in the show. And it's also not exactly typical of other Fall 97 jams. Like it definitely, Trey finds the wah-wah pedal at the end of the jam and gets into the funk. But for the first 8 or 10 minutes of it, it's really that sort of melodic, guitar-driven playing that really is not what you think of when you think of Fall 97.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. We talked about that a little bit on a couple of the previous episodes. We're only a couple shows into the tour, but it's come up already, just how balanced the playing was. I mean, we associate this tour so much with funk, you know, and of course it's there, but it's not all that. And this is that jam's a really good example. And I guess, yeah, now that you mention it, Tom, there are some things, a little bit of up and down, but that's the segue between Bathtub Gin and Llama. Like you can hear them sort of like playing Mike. It almost sounds like Mike's kind of playing Llama on the bass for a little while, and or like a prelude to Llama before they just charge right into it. And it's, man, really, really, that's a pretty great segue. There's a lot of them this tour.
I also love the fee and the antelope and with the meat stick in between or whatever it was. I remember at the show, we didn't know what Fishman was singing when he was singing the little meat stick rhyme. And I think we all thought he was singing Run Like an Antelope or something. Like he was like signaling that. And I love also the end of fee, the little harmonic jam that they go into that leads into that meat stick part. It's just, I think it's really beautiful and a fun part of the show too.
Yeah, maybe that point in the set they had found their groove, because I agree. I think that little jam is really just, I don't know, it works so well. And all this, like I said earlier, it's all kind of like burned into my brain. So every time I hear it, I'm just like, oh, this is so great. But we only heard Meat Stick up to this point as a song once in Europe in June, and then we wouldn't hear it again until 99. So it wasn't like wasn't part of the repertoire, but it was definitely happening within that jam.
Right. And I remember it showed up on the Bearsville studio tapes that circulated too. I remember when that came out, then we kind of started piecing together what Fish had done in Champagne and everything.
It's fun. They gave us little clues. Tom, there is a 10-minute limb by limb here in the first set. And this is when Limb by Limb is really starting to kind of like come together as a song. It really like filled out a lot of really cool points in these shows. It had debuted earlier in June of 97. Where did that song come from?
So this, the demo is available on that Trampled by Lambs and Pecked by the Dove album, which was consisted of three or four barn writing sessions in Vermont that Trey and I did early 97. Maybe one of them was in 96. But the lyrics started earlier and grew from a single idea in probably late 96. I sent a coworker of mine at AT&T in Somerset, New Jersey, an email that read, "Never want my hand cut off, never want a hacking cough, never need a cliff side push, never turn my brain to mush." And fortunately, that coworker was Scott Herman, and he was used to getting weird emails from me. So he responded with then, because everything was never in mind, he responded with always. And it was like, always give me what I lack, that stanza. And then I responded with left, like left is where I always turn. And then he responded to that. So now we have three stanzas, like, you know, never, always, left. And then he sent me probably some of my all-time favorite Phish lyrics, the up lines. And each one is very clever and hilarious. Up against a person who, up till now, I never knew. Up from hell, the answer blew. Up or down, it's up to you. And I loved it. So those four stanzas were the complete poem that Trey saw. And Trey had come up with this great drum track with a bass riff, you know, the famous limb by limb drum beat that we all know. He had come up with
it. Inhumane drum beat, right?
Inhumane. And he had come up with it. This might be giving away the secret, but he came up with it on a new drum machine or keyboard that he had. And I remember him saying, "This is such a hard drum beat. I could never play it, but Phish will love learning it." And Phish learned it note by note. And I bet there's some beginning drummers out there that can verify that it's probably close to impossible. And Phish has always been, he enjoyed a challenge, and Trey always enjoyed challenging him. Trey would sometimes play one track of drums and then play another on top of it. And he'd say, "Don't tell Phish that this is two tracks." But anyway, so Trey came up with those, that cool strumming guitar part, the choppy, and we sang those lyrics on top of it, of the drumming and strumming, and we were laughing. But then he said, "We need more." And he wrote an intro, and I just sang like, "This shoulder that I leaned on is carved out of stone." That was the intro. And then he grabbed a completely different poem of mine. I think I had called it Trampled by Lambs. And he created another section with those lyrics. And Trey works fast, and I remember loving the song. And I was like the engineer, because Trey had like the concept that he just wanted to put down fast. So I was like pressing play and rewind. We had an ADAT machine, I think, or the TAC version of a digital, maybe. Yeah, that was those were the ADATs, I think, back then. But anyway, pressing like rewind, play, operating the mixer, and trying to be like a you know, the engineer, and Trey just putting parts down really fast. And it came about really quick. Anyway, great collaboration song of me, Trey, and Scott Herman.
My friends and I use the left is how I always turn line quite often. It's like, whenever, where are we going? Well, left is how I always turn.
I'm glad.
And this wasn't the first time you had randomly sent Scott some lyrics, right?
No, certainly not.
He was expecting it.
Yeah. I think he expected it daily. And anytime I was bored at work, which was all the time, I would send him something. So that's why we had just a buttload of stuff. RJ, I do want to ask something now that I'm thinking about it. You were very excited to get to this show, right? Like extremely, maybe too excited.
Yeah, we were, my friend had inherited some money and got a BMW M3 with like the Dynan, you know, the Dynan like supercharged engine. I mean, this is, first of all, for an 18-year-old, this is totally inappropriate to have this car. But I was driving from Toledo to Columbus to meet him there to then leave to go to Champaign. And I was going through this one area where the speed limit was 25, and I got a ticket for going 60 in a 25. And I had no idea that I was even going that fast, because this car, like, you couldn't even drive it under 25 miles per hour, because once you pressed the gas pedal, you were going 60. And I think because the car was so fancy, the cop like actually thought that I was I think I would have gotten in more trouble if it was a crappy car, but because it was like a nice new fancy car, he just gave me a regular speeding ticket and sent me on my way. And it was just way too powerful for me. And then kind of like the show is kind of way too powerful for my brain, but I made it on time thanks to this overly fancy car, and I never drove it again because I was basically afraid to. Nice. It was wild.
But worth it once you got to the show.
Yes.
Any other thoughts about set one? Because we can take a break and talk about set two when we return. What do you think, Andy? Take a break?
I think the break's good, yeah.
Okay. And we'll be back and talking about the amazing second set when we return after this quick break.
Hey, listeners, I want to tell you about one of our great partners, DistroKid. DistroKid makes music distribution fun and easy with unlimited uploads and artists keeping 100% of their royalties and earnings. If you're a musician and looking to get your music out there, DistroKid is the way to go. DistroKid is available for iOS and Android and is now available in Apple's App Store and the Google Play Store. More than a million artists rely on DistroKid to get their music onto Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram, and all other major streaming services. And with DistroKid, you can upload new releases, see your financial progress, get notified when you've earned royalties, withdraw money from the app, view and share links, check your streaming stats, and a whole lot more. DistroKid has more features than any other music distributor. Check them out today. Go to distrokid.com, that's DistroKid with a capital K, .com/VIP/undermine for a special offer only for our listeners. That's DistroKid, capital K, .com/VIP/undermine. Thanks, DistroKid.
Hey, what's up? This is Blake Weiland. I'm the host of the Tone Mob Podcast. It's a show where I interview guitar people about guitar stuff. We talk about their pedals, their amps, their accessories, their preferences, all that stuff, as well as a healthy dose of whatever comes up. Topics have ranged from aliens to addiction and anywhere in between. Oh yeah, and pizza. We're definitely going to be talking about pizza. So get the show wherever you're listening to this podcast at. Just search The Tone Mob in your search bar and it will pop right up. Come join us. We're having a lot of fun. Thanks for checking it out.
And we're back. We're here with Andy Kahn to talk about set two of November 19th, 1997 in Champaign, Illinois. RJ, take over.
So Andy, you mentioned you were at the 95 show here, right? They played yes. Three shows here, 95, 96, 97, all fall. And this was the last time they would play at this venue. I mean, I think we need to bring Fish back at some point.
I would love it. Yeah. It's a cool place. It's one of those arenas too, that feels small, you know, it's very like kind of tall and rises up and circular. And so you kind of just feel like everybody's kind of leaning forward at the same time and watching it, you know, in anticipation.
Yeah. Yeah. The second set, I mean, so four song second set, you know, and just incredible, incredible playing here. I have some thoughts on this whole thing, but Andy, what's your, I guess, like highlighter, or how do you think about this set?
You know, when I think about it, I go first, I think, to the Wolfman's. You know, I've been listening back to it a couple of times over the past few days. There's the soundboard version of it that's on one of the Denver Live Fish release as a bonus. So it just sounds great, and what struck me is that, like, there's each member of the band kind of has a few minutes to shine. Like there's a part where Trey's out in front, then there's a part where Paige comes forward, then there's a part that's like clearly Mike in control, and Fish starts laying down different rhythms that they follow, and it's just really this like almost made me think of like a jazz band where it's like each person solos, but it's not soloing because they're all doing it together. It's just, there's one person that's kind of taking charge or being more assertive at times, but throughout the whole thing, it's just this really cool exploratory jam that unfolds in a really diverse way.
We'll be right back.
That's a really good way to put it. Yeah, I was thinking, like, when I was listening to it again today, like, it just feels like they just kind of are cycling through different themes and ideas, and it's almost like it's like a sound check or band practice or something, right? With each of them kind of like leading through a different segment. The 2001, I've said this a couple times, but all this music is just totally like burned into my brain. Like, he has the little like false start at the beginning of 2001, and then, you know, it's like 17 minutes of just funky jams, but without any slowing down. I think we talked about the Europe earlier this year, the Europe shows where the funk kind of started to appear, but it was much more mellow. And this is just the 2001. It just sort of slowly builds intensity as it goes on, and it just feels like they're in like such control of this. And then the Wolfman's is just, it's so out there. The crazy part about the Wolfman's is like about 11 minutes in, it's like kind of slowing down a little bit, and then Trey just changes the direction completely. And he just starts like just playing these chords really fast, and then everyone just kind of falls in line, and then it just like it kind of takes off from there. It felt like we were watching a band just practice.
Yeah, and the cool cross-eyed and painless little riff that he throws in there too, that kind of, I think everybody, it helps everybody kind of find a new pathway, and it steers them into another new awesome territory. It's really one of my favorite jams that I've seen live, for sure.
Yeah. We just talked, RJ, in another interview. I'm not sure exactly what show it was that we were talking to someone about, and you explained jam charts. And this entire second set might be the only set where every single song is jam charted.
And the encore. Yeah.
And the encore.
It's yeah. it's all jam charted. Yeah. I mean, this
even Makisupa.
The four song second set, it's gotta be solid unless someone like, you know, unless they just left early. But this is it's just amazing. I love the segue into Makisupa, which is, you know, really, you know, in line with the era of being just like a funky, but also, what does Trey say? Dank kind.
Yeah.
Which is just so, it's so 90s, you know, it's like,
stink kind.
Yeah. Which is like, it's very 90s. That's like, I'm sure what we were trying to figure out in the parking lot before, you know, it's really great. It's a really good version of Makisupa. And then this, and Taste is just closes a set. I mean, really, I don't know. We've talked about this with a couple of these jams, but there's just this build that keeps going, but it doesn't feel forced or even overly intentional. It just sort of like these jams just build slowly, and then the peaks are really, really cool. It's really fascinating to listen to.
Like a self-propulsion that takes over, it seems like. And I like to use the term, you know, the music plays them. And it seems like this show was definitely, particularly in the second set, there was a lot of that, just, you know, letting the hose flow, you know, and grabbing it out of the air and having it show up for all of us to hear.
I like also the idea that the audience is playing the band. Like you just said, the music is playing them. Audience, yeah. it like RJ had said, is so every tiny little sub solo or sub peak, they freak out. Just, I think everyone was just absolutely, it was one of those perfect shows where the band and the audience is in sync and everyone's having an unbelievable time.
And during the Possum, there's clapping along. It wouldn't be a fish show in the Midwest in the 90s without some audience clapping along.
A really good
to participate.
Really good one too. I mean, a really good possum. Yeah. I mean, that's the, I remember, Andy, I remember getting some Europe tapes and some summer tapes, and I saw some summer shows as you did. What were your expectations going into this at this point? I mean, were you expecting to see what you saw?
No, not at all. Although, I mean, I did see Deer Creek, and that, you know, I did see a four song set, second set there that summer, the infamous show. But, you know, I think really what I was into were the new songs, Dirt and Limb by Limb. I had only seen them once before. I only had a handful of tapes with those songs on them. So getting to see those, I think, was something that I was really looking forward to. And then, no offense, Tom, I always say my favorite Fish song is a 20-minute jam. And so getting that heavy dose of improvisation in the second set was just exactly what I was hoping for and still searching for. You know, that's still why I keep going to see shows.
None taken.
But these are, I mean, these songs that, like, Dirt, which again appeared in June of 97 and was played a bunch up to this point, and ends up, you know, being a staple. But that was new at this point, along with Limb by Limb, and there are a bunch of others that showed up throughout the tour. And for those of us who didn't get to see, you know, Europe or didn't hear all the tapes, it was awesome to be exposed to a bunch of new songs while also just this brand new style of jamming. Andy, in case we don't talk to you again, you know, for the rest of Fall 97, what do you, looking back 25 years later, like, what do you see as the importance of this tour, and how do you look at it, especially from a journalistic perspective? Like, do you have any perspective on kind of the importance of this tour for Fish's career?
You know, Jambase did a retrospective for the 20th anniversary 5 years ago, and we had a bunch of different people write essays about each of the shows. And I think back to that, and I think to just the way that there's the Fish community agrees that this was such a significant moment in their history, that these shows are special, that they're worth revisiting after 20 years, after 25 years, and that there's a timelessness about them. It's even though it is, you know, defining by the cow funk of the fall 97 or whatever, you could still listen to these shows over and over and over. And they have a lastingness to them that I don't really know that I find in a lot of the other eras. I find myself listening to Fall 97 way more than any other era of the band. It was formative for me. It was really early on in my sort of Fish fandom, but not so early that I wasn't way into it, you know, and it just gave me the bug even more. And like I said, it just stands the test of time, really.
I think that's a great way for us to wrap this up. But I have to mention that a coincidence, RJ, you mentioned your, you know, the speeding ticket issue. And about 3 hours ago, I told our friend Scott Gray, who appeared on an earlier episode this season, that I was doing this show. And he wrote, completely coincidentally, just now, without knowing what we're talking about, "The Wolfman's Brother from that show is dangerous to listen to while driving a sports car." So I wonder if he got a ticket too. I asked him, but he hasn't answered. So
that's amazing.
Yeah. That's cool.
I hope there's this. Yeah. Well, I hope he didn't get in trouble, but I hope he has a story, because his stories are amazing.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, that's it for us today. Thank you so much, Andy Kahn. And, thanks for all you do at Jambase, and to all our friends there at Jambase. Thanks to all you listeners, and thank you very much, the Osiris team behind the scenes. A quick shout out to Cash or Trade, the world's only social network where fans buy, sell, and trade tickets at face value. Check them out at cashortrade.org. Please remember to review and subscribe wherever you listen or watch. Goodbye, and also remember to blaze on. Thanks, guys. Thanks, RJ.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for doing this, Andy.
So long. Thanks for having me. Thanks, guys. Osiris.
Hey, this is Steve Choi, host of the Musicians Guild podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media podcast network. Within the four walls of the Musicians Guild, we'll be discussing the habits, idiosyncrasies, experiences, and general psychology of my friends and peers all involved with music in various capacities. Listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com.
Ever wonder what a punch from Elton John feels like?
Or how you cope with having turned down the chance to be in Nirvana?
Or what signal Keith Richards gives when he wants you to get the hell out of his hotel room?
Fans of Too Much Effing Perspective don't have to wonder, because they've heard these exact stories and a jillion others on our podcast. I'm Alex Hoffman, former tour manager for Radiohead.
And I'm musician and comedy writer Alan Keller. On the TMEP show, we get guests like Nancy Wilson from Heart, Jeremiah Frates from The Lumineers, and Modern Family's Julie Bowen to tell us things they may have only shared with their therapist, clergy, or a TMZ stringer.
So join us on Too Much Effing Perspective. That's EFFING Perspective, the only podcast you crank up to 11.